Alonzo so Walling met her at the train. That night plot unfolded, poor Pearl lost her life. Scott and Alonzo both hung for that crime.
Ghoulish greetings, everybody. Those tunes you just heard are courtesy of my good friend, Bobby Mackey, and I, of course, am your host, Tessa Morrow. Thanks so much for stopping by and making Paranormal Prowlers Podcast part of your morning, day, night, whenever you listen and wherever you listen from tiny remote village to isolated island to the scorching desert, the big city, and everything in between, it is absolutely appreciated. This week's special city shoutouts go to Marsden Park, Australia, Kane, Illinois, El Matorral, Spain. Yes, Tessa Morrow, butcherer of names. Long Beach, California, San Salvador, El Salvador, and Odenville, Alabama. So for the past several weeks, about like 2 or 3 months, my aunt and I have been working on this project. And it has to do with my grandpa and his World War II journal entries and pictures and everything. And we've been having so much fun with it. And I thought that today, after finishing up the Rocker Death series, that I would read a journal entry to you, taking you to the front and center of World War II and what my grandpa experienced himself. This journal entry was titled Snafu, Start of 62nd Battalion Up to Overseas. And this is what he had to say. Some guys had military duty in Paris. Some in New York. Some in Denver. And some near the beaches of Florida. Some near the beaches of California. Where was my initial duty? Oklahoma. Lots in Oklahoma. Can you imagine? Oklahoma. Oh, well. I shouldn't complain. It could be Texas. Or it could even be Siberia. Fort Sill, Oklahoma, 7 miles from the city of Lawton, a town of some 19,000 people covered a vast area. There was upwards of 90,000 soldiers, which included regular army men, new enlistees, and new draftees. There were rows upon rows upon rows of identical two-story barracks as far as the eye could see. The land appeared to be very arid, hot, and dusty. This nightmare place, ugh, was to be my home for the next 9 months. Can you imagine the congestion that prevailed every evening when a large percentage of 90,000 GIs invaded the small town of Lawton in quest of food, movies, shopping? Girls? Girls? I don't think so. Anyhow, Lawton, Oklahoma had wall-to-wall soldiers filling out its crowded streets every single night. A guy in his early 20s, away from home, in a strange area, naturally entertains thoughts about visiting and cavorting with young maidens of the opposite sex. No way was a guy going to meet that girl he went to sleep dreaming about every night. One could not anticipate a social life in Lawton. I doubt if Clark Gable could make out there. At the fort, canteens were situated about every 10 miles. If you felt like imbibing in a bottle of beer or refreshment or even a sandwich, forget it. The canteens were so crowded, there was no place to sit. And, for that matter, no place to even stand. You couldn't get close to the pool tables or the ping pong tables or the pinball machines. And, of course, if you get a pass and went into Lawton to a movie or to a restaurant, you had to buck large lines, many of which winded clear around the block. It was really a hassle. At first, friends of mine and I clamored to get a pass every night so we could go into town. But it was, as I mentioned, such a hassle that soon we lost that desire and we were forced to seek other diversions in the barracks, like playing poker or blackjack or shooting craps. And when you went broke, more often than not, you could always read a book or write letters back home. One day, My best buddy, Dave Doherty, from Flint, Michigan, who arrived at Fort Sill the same day I did, said,
"Hey, Jerry, I have good news. My brother is driving in from home, and guess what? He's bringing me my car."
It was very rare for a GI to have a car at the training center in the early days of the war. So Dave, I was just beginning to find out, came from a very wealthy family. His dad was a top executive of the Buick division of General Motors. A couple of days later, Dave's brother called from Lawton. That evening, we went into town, and there it sat. Oh, a beautiful, new black 1942 convertible Buick. What a break now. Instead of us sweating out the long lines waiting to catch a bus into Lawton, and then sweating out a bus on the return trip to the fort so we could beat the bed check deadline, we could leisurely leave and come and go with no problem. Isn't it funny? All of a sudden, Dave acquired a lot of erstwhile friends. Now we decided, Dave and I, could abandon our quest for social diversions in the quagmire Lawton and sniff around areas less populated by the military, where we could be large frogs in a little pond instead of being little frogs in a big pond as we were in Lawton. After a period of 5 weeks where we did nothing but drill, calisthenics, and more drill, five of us from our barracks were called to the orderly room and told that we were being transferred to another area to begin a new type of training. This new deal was very interesting. It, for us, was like going to college. The Army was setting up a new facility known as the Flash and Sound Division of the Field Artillery. It was structured so that enemy gun emplacements could be pinpointed by means of computations taken from results of the flashes and sounds of enemy artillery. Dave and I figured that we were very fortunate to be a part of this new assignment. We were excused from most of the drab Army duties, such as guard duty and KP duty. Our average day began with reveille at 6 a.m., 30 minutes of calisthenics, 30 minutes of close order drill, then to the mess hall for breakfast. And after breakfast, classes all day till 4 in the afternoon. At 5, we had retreat, the lowering of the colors. Then we were free till the next morning. All the guys in our barracks were students in this new training. Most of them were college men. And I felt kind of in awe with my 1 year of college, surrounded by all of these intellectuals, graduates from renowned schools such as MIT, Stanford, Colorado School of Mines, and other famous schools. It was nice, however, because as long as I had to be in the Army, it was great that I was ensconced in a situation with such a bunch of swell guys. Several weeks after, we started our schooling in Flash and Sound. Dave and I were given a weekend pass. We thought we would drive to Oklahoma City and see what we could manifest there as far as a diversion. Driving north, some 60 miles from Lawton, we arrived at a small city called Chickasha. It was a real nice, clean town, and what impressed us the most was that we drove for many blocks and not one GI did we see. We stopped at a drugstore to get some cigarettes. There in the front was a long soda fountain, and in the back of the room, a large area filled with booths and tables. And to our utter surprise, almost every booth, every seat, had a rear end sitting in it. The best looking room full of rear ends that ever in my life did I see. A room full of pulchritude. The room was filled with young college age girls. All of a sudden, Dave and I acquired a deep thirst and decided that we should locate a couple of seats in the back of the room, set our rear ends down in the seats, and have a malt. I imagine that we too, in that room full of females, were quite a novelty because in no time, we had our two rear ends in a booth occupied by two feminine rear ends who seemed to be eager to share their rear ends with us, two reps of the United States Army. Quite a few weeks had transpired without either one of us even close to a girl. So it was strictly elation time for Dave and I here in this innocuous little town in Oklahoma. We truly struck the mother lode. The town had two girl colleges. As Lawton was overrun by boys, Chickasha was overrun with girls, and we definitely decided that as long as we were stationed in Oklahoma, this would be our haven. This would be our paradise. This would be our headquarters. The two girls that we latched on to invited us to a sorority dance that night where we had a great time, after which we four drove to Oklahoma City and spent a beautiful, exciting weekend. Those Oklahoma girls, woo-wee! So far, my time in the Army was very uneventful. It was not like we were at war, of course. There was more to come. Yes, much, much more to come. Now, I was approaching a new phase. Six of us from our section were called in and informed that we had passed a qualification test necessary for us to enter Officers Training School, OCS. Dave also qualified. We were transferred to another area where for 90 days we were to be involved in a very rigid educational program and a very rigorous physical training program. I wasn't sure whether I really wanted to be an officer and a gentleman or if I wanted to just be a plain G.I. Joe. I opted for the officer's gig and soon embarked on the program, which was very interesting as well as very educational. I opted for the officer's gig and soon embarked on the program, which was very interesting as well as very educational. One morning, as we were doing some pretty heavy calisthenics, I was stricken with a sharp pain in my left groin area. I was put on a stretcher and taken to the base hospital. It was determined that I had a rupture that would require immediate surgery. My doctor checked my service record and said,
"How did you ever get drafted in the Army? Your medical record shows that you had this hernia prior to your being sworn in, and you should have been classified as 4F and not drafted."
He also indicated that if I pursued it, I could probably receive a medical discharge. And I thought to myself, thanks a lot. I go through all this crap of leaving my job in Washington, D.C., getting drafted, going through all the basic training, and now I'm told that all this could have been avoided because some jackass overlooked this hernia presence when I was sworn in? I thought, should I apply for a discharge or just go ahead and get my officer's commission and see what happens? In the ensuing years, I kicked myself in the rear many times for making the decision, which obviously was to sweat out the Army. In a way, after it was all over, I'm happy that things ended up the way that they did. I had experiences, some very traumatic, some very sad, some very nostalgic. I would not go through that again, but I wouldn't trade it for the world. I had the surgery. How different surgery was then and now in the 80s. Now they have you up and walking the same day after the knife. Then, though, I remained in bed 21 days after the surgery. I couldn't even get up to go to the can. It's tough after you finally get up and try to walk. You feel as though you are walking on a bed of needles. The nice thing about going through the drudgery of the last few weeks was that I got a 15-day medical furlough, which happily I took and which sadly ended too soon. Before I knew it, I was kissing all my family and all my girlfriends goodbye again. And I was back in Fort Sill. I was anxious to resume officers' training, but before I could do that, I had to report to the hospital for a checkup and a release. I couldn't believe it, but the checkup produced sad news for me. The doctor, checking me, discovered that I was ruptured on my right groin side, and I would have to have surgery again. Well, after another lifetime, 21 days, and another convalescent furlough, 15 days, I was back again at Fort Sill Hospital for my final checkup. Now, again, I was looking forward to resuming officers' training, but alas, they at the hospital said I was not physically able to begin the strain of OCS, and that I would have to be on the light duty for 6 weeks, after which I could, if completely healthy, finish the rigors of OCS training. 6 weeks of light duty. 5 weeks later, I was on a ship heading for the invasion of North Africa. Typical Army snafu. 2 weeks for OCS, but just fine to go into combat. My light duty consisted of company clerk duties, a lot of typing, in the orderly room. After about 3 weeks of that, a directive came down which ordered that 40 men from our company were being transferred. I asked the company commander about my situation and officer's training, and he said that I could probably pursue that at the new place where I was being transferred. I loaded all my possessions in my barracks bag, a large canvas bag, something like a gunny sack, and loaded on this troop train, which, after 30 hours of trekking eastward, stopped, and we unloaded at a large area as far as you could see. All that you could see were tents. We were in Virginia at an army installation known as Camp AP Hill. This was a staging area primarily used to prepare troops for overseas duty. I was assigned to a pyramidal tent that had 8 army cots in it. So far, my army accommodations, although nothing to compare to my private room at home, were quite comfortable. If you could refer to sleeping in a barracks with 100 GIs in it as being comfortable. It seems like every time you step down, comfort-wise, you really bitch about your present accommodation as compared to the last one. The first night that I spent in this present accommodation so far was the most miserable night I could ever remember. It was late in November, and we were in Virginia, and frost, it was on the ground. At the supply tent, we were issued combat clothing, which included a heavy overcoat and a large army blanket. This blanket served as my only cover that I had on my cot that night. I slept with my clothes on and a heavy overcoat, but I still froze my whatcha-call-it off. It was a damp cold that nestled on your bones, and it refused to leave. Would that I was back in the warm barracks in that cesspool, Fort Sill, Oklahoma. Little did I realize that this frozen pyramidal tent would seem like the Hotel Astor compared to some of the nights I spent later on in the war, where I slept in a foxhole in the snow, on the ground, with a horse turd for a pillow. Incidentally, the horse turd was frozen. I was assigned to a battalion, the 62nd Armored Field Artillery Battalion, and it consisted mostly of regular army men, quite a few of whom were 30-year career soldiers. There's a big difference in the type of men that I first was stationed with at Fort Sill and the 30-year career soldier, most of, it should say, that about 90% of the cadre, non-commissioned officers, of the 62nd were regular army, and a lot of them were not too well educated. As a matter of fact, I found out later that my first sergeant left school after the 6th grade, and I thought to myself, what kind of an outfit am I getting in? I'm thinking, I've only been a soldier for less than a year and I've already experienced quite a few snafus, beginning when I was drafted as a IA with a hernia, to now being assigned to this outfit when I was trained in the flash and sound, and not physically able to finish OCS but fit to go into combat. I thought, yeah, lots of snafus so far, but I'm sure there will be a lot more to come. The 62nd was an outfit that was trained to participate in lightning warfare. It consisted of what was referred to as 3 gun batteries, 1 service battery, and headquarters battery. Each gun battery had 7 M7s, and M7 is an armored vehicle similar to a tank with a 106mm howitzer gun mounted on it. Each battery had 20 half-tracks, armored vehicles with front wheels and rear tracks like those on tanks. Each battery also had a number of jeeps and weasels, which are small armored, fast-moving vehicles on tracks. The service battery responsibilities consisted of servicing and maintaining all the vehicles and equipment in the battalion, and to provide clothing, food, guns, and ammunition, and all equipment necessary for all the personnel in the battalion. The medical detachment, which consisted of a doctor, a dentist, and about 20 corpsmen, was also a part of the service battery. Headquarters battery was the boss of the battalion. It handled all the administrative functions, kept all the personnel records, had the 5-2 section, which took care of the maps and paperwork necessary to participate in an armored type war. The 5-3 section, also a part of headquarters battery, was responsible for the operations of the whole battalion. In combat, all the gun batteries defended on HQ battery to set them up position-wise and to manage whatever had to be done in the face of the enemy, such as locating the enemy positions and directing offensives on them. I'm spending many words describing the 62nd Armored, but that was my home for the next 3 years, so a guy should expend a few words on a 3-year home. After an interview with the battery commander, I was assigned to the 5-3 section of headquarters battery and was referred to as a computer. The job of a computer while in combat was to receive information from a forward observer as to the location of enemy positions to compute their position in records to our gun positions and then to forward the approximate range and deflection to our gun batteries. And it took me several days to become acclimated to my new organization. The first impression I had of this outfit was that everyone seemed to have a very serious attitude about life in general. As I mentioned before, most of the NCOs were old army men, and they didn't seem to have much love for the new guys who just came into their ballywick, most of whom were like me, new draftees. Sergeant May, headquarters first sergeant, was very tough on us at first. We new guys were the first to be picked for all the menial duties such as KP duty, guard duty, and latrine duty. Latrines, of course, were toilets, wooden platforms with holes in them, sitting over 6-foot ditches with a canvas cover stretched around to ensure semi-privacy. I got on the first sergeant's shit list immediately because Major Bier, head of the 5-3 section to which I was assigned, got me excused from the above-mentioned duties. He said that I was training to do the work of a T sergeant and should not be subjected to menial duties. First Sergeant May was upset about that, but I sort of appeased him by telling him that I would rather not be in the 5-3 section and that I would just as soon be with those average new draftees. Oh yeah, you know how much I meant that, ha ha. At least saying that kept him off my back, though. One nice thing about my getting into this strange new outfit was the fact that several hundred new men came into the 62nd when I did, and most of them were pretty intelligent civilian types. Quite a few of them were taken out of Air Force training units. Most of them were like me. They had never seen a rifle, or a grenade, or a pup tent, or an outside latrine. The color green had to be the label of me, and all the other young recruits who just entered the 62nd Armored Field Artillery Battalion. We had a lot to learn, and, unfortunately, our education was going to have to come from actual combat experience. Thank God we were only at AP Hill 12 days. The nights were miserably cold, and the latrines, try sitting on a board with a hole in it that's covered with frost. I think I should have applied for a medical discharge back at Fort Sill, but now, forget it, and forget resuming officers' training. We were on our way to go overseas. We were on our way to get into a little war. We were on our way to get into a little hell. Shortly, we were back on a troop train heading northeast. This time, our train ride was a little shorter. Fort Dix, New Jersey, just across the river from the big city, New York. We were at Fort Dix for 2 weeks. All we did there was make final preparations for our sojourn overseas. We were issued rifles, ammunition, shelter halves, and everything that it took for a soldier going into combat. And we underwent physical and dental and short arm, ask any GI what that means, inspections. We were given passes into New York every day. And I must admit, that one's first trip there, at least mine was, it was an adventure all in itself. The city is awesome. I could write many pages about my thoughts about New York City, but herein, I will confine just 3 experiences that I most remember when I was first there. St. Patrick's Cathedral was a number one on my priority list for places I most wanted to see. And what can I say about that? It is magnificent, and I am real thankful that I was able to see it. I will never forget it. One evening, my friend Bill Wiltz and I decided that we would go to the famous Roseland Ballroom. We first stopped at Sardi's, one of New York's most exclusive restaurants. We had dinner there, then we went to Roseland. The dance floor there was about as large as 2 football fields, and it was beautifully decorated. The deal there was this. For 10 cents, you could dance with one of the more than several hundred girls. And if I remember, you paid $2 to get in. Then you bought a strip of 10 tickets for $1 and gave the girl a ticket for each dance. I spotted a beautiful girl that struck my fancy. And it took some time for me to catch her when she was free, but I finally did. And her name was Maxine. She was real nice and very pleasant. I was so stricken with her that I used up my whole strip of tickets dancing with just her. I asked her if I could have a date with her, and she said she would meet me at the USO Club in Times Square on Sunday at 5 p.m. So Sunday came, and Bill and I got a pass, and we went into the USO Club, where we had lunch about 1 o'clock. And I couldn't believe that USO Club. It was very large, very plush. It had a beautiful lobby and restaurant, and a large room with a dance floor, and a room with 20 pool tables, ping pong tables, and a long row of pinball machines. And after we ate, we were playing ping pong when a lady came over to us, and she said that an Actors Guild was holding a huge party at the nearby Astor Hotel, and they were inviting 10 soldiers, 10 Marines, and 10 sailors to attend, and would we like to go? Well, we of course jumped at the chance, and the lady wrote us a note that we were to hand in at the hotel desk when we went over to the hotel. And I gasped when we went into the lobby. Talk about swank. It was indeed a 10. It was very plush, and it reeked of millions. The desk clerk had a bellhop escort us many, many stories up to the roof, where the elevator opened up to this huge ballroom. There were two bands there, one of whom was one of the top big name bands in the country, led by Glenn Miller. The room was teeming with people, men in tuxedos, and what almost made my eyes pop out, many, many beautiful girls, all attired in formals. We stood there gawking like rubes that we were when a beautiful girl came over to us, greeted us, had us check our hat and coat, and took us over to a table, sat us down, and brought two girls over to join us. She said that everything for us was free and for us to just enjoy. And it was really nice. After a couple of drinks, we really got into the swing of it. I closed my eyes and just thought, boy, how nice these millionaires live. I remembered I had to awaken from my dream and go pick up Maxine, with whom I had the date with at 5 o'clock. I told the girl that I had been cavorting with all afternoon about Maxine, and she said, sure, go get her, bring her over here. So I left. And on my way over to the USO, I thought, I doubt if Maxine is even going to be there. But much to my surprise, she was inside by the door waiting for me. And I said, come on, honey, you and I are going to Astor. She laughed, thinking I was kidding. Then, when we went in the lobby, she thought I was truly a big operator. But I explained how we got invited. They had certain elevators going up to the roof. And when we went to get on one, this guy came up to me and said
that no more people could get up to that party.
And I explained to him that I had already been up there and that my hat and overcoat was still there and that we were going up. We got on the elevator and he was very adamant about us not going up. And I told him I wasn't going to get off the elevator. We were beginning to get kind of loud and he called security. And when he came, I told him I wanted to see the hotel manager. He took me to his office, and after I explained the situation, he escorted us up himself. So I had the distinction of almost getting kicked out of one of the top hotels in the United States of America. We had a great time at the party. Just think, I could dance all afternoon to music by Glenn Miller, and I didn't have to give Maxine a 10-cent ticket. Maxine, she was really a sweet girl, and I regret not being able to spend more time with her. We wrote to each other long after I went overseas. We made many plans to see each other after the war. Well, one night when I was in France, I got a letter from her sister who said that Maxine was home visiting her folks in Indiana and that she was killed in a freak auto accident. Oh, the irony! Me going to war, no scratches! Her, at home, a freak accident, dead! Ugh. Well, comes the time when the anticipated comes to pass. Many, many months we had been sweating out the day when we were to set sail for the land across, and I thought, What does this new phase in our screwy life have in store for us now? Like a shipload of sheep, not knowing where we are going or what is in store for us when we get there. What does this phase hold for us? For sure, we were either going to shoot someone's ass off or we were going to get ours shot off. The Sunday that we had such a good time in New York was our last day pass. 3 days after that, we were awakened at 4 a.m. and told to get all our equipment ready as we were going to leave and board a ship at 10 a.m. So normal snafu procedure, we boarded at 10 o'clock that night. We had to tote on our back our full-filled equipment, shelter half small tent, pole, and stakes, and our one army blanket, and carry our rifle and our barracks bag with all our clothing in it. So we were pretty well loaded down. When we got to the dock area, we walked 1.5 miles to where the ship was. By the time we walked up a long gangplank to get in the ship, and then down the narrow ladder ways to get to the holds where the bunks were, we were completely pooped. The bunks were stacked 3 high and packed very close together. You can literally say that we were jam-packed. I just was so exhausted that I just lay on my bunk and I passed out. Sometime about 4 a.m, I awoke with a very funny feeling. The ship was moving. It seemed like it was weaving slightly. And it was a very unusual feeling knowing that at last we were on our way. So that is just a tiny entry that my grandpa wrote. And it's interesting because he wrote this in the 80s. And obviously it's about World War II and his time there. But it's like, I just love reading this stuff because it's like there's some things that I knew about, but then others I didn't. And he just is so detailed. And we have all these letters he wrote back home and pictures. Like, I think he's in a field in Germany and he's helping milk a cow with this beautiful maiden. Just like really interesting and cool stuff. So since we just did a series of 5, you know, shortly before that, we did the Route 66 series. So it will be something different next week, but definitely expect a part 2 when it comes to my Grandpa Gerald and his phenomenal journal entries. These men and women, I have nothing but respect for, just like our law enforcement, our firefighters, our EMTs, and just our precious, precious veterans and what they went through. And the ones who didn't die saw people close to them die in brutal ways. Never forgetting it, my heart just goes out to all of you brave men and women. And speaking of veterans, I know I've mentioned him before, but my grandpa, not Gerald, but my grandpa Ernie, who just turned 100 years old in May, I get to see him in a couple days, so I am just super excited about that. Anyways, you know a veteran? Give him a hug. Did you enjoy this week's episode? Listen to the others. They're all fantastic. Haven't heard every single damn one yet? Really, there is no need to fret, my friends. Just hit up any of those phenomenal podcast platforms, such as Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Player FM, TuneIn Radio, Downcast, Deezer. Basically, wherever you may roam to hear your other spooky podcasts, you'll probably find Paranormal Prowlers podcast lurking in the background. Thanks, everybody.
See you next week.